KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
There are times where, like, I would look at Agent Carter and I'd be very jealous of Tara's budget. It's all in good fun, though. We are fans of each other's work. So it's hard to be in competition with someone who actually, like, writes the kind of stuff you wish you were writing.
For married couple Mark Guggenheim and Tara Butters, the rivalry between Marvel and DC Comics got personal. Guggenheim was producing the DC Comics show Arrow for the CW with Greg Berlanti, while Butters was showrunner on Marvel's Agent Carter on ABC. The couple talks about what it's like to work in the competing universes. Then the filmmakers of the new Netflix documentary, Amanda Knox, knew they couldn't make their film until they could get Knox herself to talk to them. Given that she was on trial for murder in Italy, that meant waiting years. But first on the News Banter, wedding bells for Viacom and CBS? Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So the big news this past week has been the letter that has been dispatched by National Amusements, the company that oversees both Viacom and CBS. Viacom, of course, is the company that includes Paramount Pictures, the troubled Paramount Pictures, MTV. Well, they're all troubled. MTV, Nickelodeon, Comedy Central, all of these properties. So years ago, as you know, 10 years ago, they were split apart by Sumner Redstone in a move that a lot of people didn't particularly like. Many people thought CBS would struggle as network TV became more challenged and that Viacom would be the growth company. Turned out to be the diametric opposite. And now with Sherry Redstone, the daughter of the mogul Sumner Redstone, who put all of this together, finally in the driver's seat after a big power struggle at Viacom, it looks like she is basically saying, I would like these two companies to go back together again, and many on Wall Street agree.
Yeah, the stocks of both companies went up when the letter was sent saying this is a possibility. I think the key question is the leadership and what the leadership of the combined company would be. The betting money is on Leslie Moonves simply taking over both companies and figuring out which elements he wants to keep, which parts he wants to sell off, bringing in an experienced film executive to run the film part of that company. But if you're going to place a bet, I would put a bet on this actually happening.
Yeah, I think that the key is the personnel issue. Leslie Moonves is one of the most respected executives in the media world. The former head of Viacom, who was expensively and with a long struggle sent on his way, was Philippe Domon, one of the least respected executives in the media world. Viacom was just trashed by all accounts under his poor leadership. And when you look around for someone to run Viacom, it's not like at that level with a company this troubled, there's a bunch of candidates that you are dying to bring in or who are available and want to take it on as a standalone, especially Leslie Moonves, from Sherry Redstone's point of view, has to be the answer. Now he's playing a bit of a reluctant bridegroom because he doesn't want any appearance that CBS shareholders are going to get the worst of this deal, whatever form it might take.
Right. That's his dilemma right there. He's got to think of his own shareholders, but I'm sure he's also thinking of his own domain as well. And, you know, the buzz has been that for years he has wanted to increase his power and increase his standing by taking on some of these properties. So I think he's ultimately going to get it.
He's probably going to get it on very good terms. And then, yes, I do think there will be a lot of changes in Viacom and at Paramount, which has really struggled this year. Meanwhile, you know, as we said, CBS has done really well despite all expectations. We have the new fall season. That isn't going quite so well for the networks generally. CBS has a possible hit in Bull, which is this thing based on Dr. Phil, improbably. And ABC seems to have a possible hit in Designated Survivor with Kiefer Sutherland as the unexpected president of the United States following a horrible terrorist attack. Other than that, you know, there are no big breakouts, like Empire-like breakouts, and nobody seems to have an outright disaster yet.
No, I mean, the expectations for broadcast television these days are so low that you're seeing these shows debut with a, you know, 2.2 rating, a 2 rating, and those are considered okay. They're considered successes. The big issue will be, what are the numbers on the Live Plus 3, Live Plus 7? Those are the numbers that the executives actually care about now. There's been this shift away from the overnights. And you're seeing these shows like This Is Us on NBC and Designated Survivor on ABC. They're not only doing okay on the live overnights, but they're doing better when they factor in the Live Plus 3. And that means that people are sampling. That said, the overnight ratings for premiere week were down double digits again. They were down 12% from last year, which was down from the year before. So the trajectory is still the same. People are watching less TV the night that it airs, and they're watching less of the broadcast networks.
Although if a network executive were here, they would, again, tell you, do not look at those overnight ratings. They're no longer relevant. I don't even know why we do them anymore. So that is what their position on that is. Now, turning to a place that is causing a lot of the challenges for the networks, that is Netflix. Netflix has become a juggernaut of original programming, and also a place where people watch shows that are old. You know, it is a giant, aggressive player in the industry right now. Many fear and resent it while relying on its money in this industry. But they have been poaching a lot of executives. I'm told they even have a scoreboard. That's the scuttlebutt in the town of where they've poached executives from. And I'm also told that their attitude is, you know, just sue us. And sure enough, Fox just sued them.
Very interesting lawsuit. Fox is not suing the people who left. There were two executives who defected from Fox companies over to Netflix. They're not suing those executives. They're suing Netflix for inducing a breach of contract because those executives were under contract. And Netflix, in a very interesting statement in response to the lawsuit, basically said Netflix does not believe executive contracts are enforceable, which is a very aggressive stance to take. California law is very favorable towards mobility and allowing people to work wherever they'd like. However, these executives were under contract, and what Netflix is essentially saying is that executive contracts mean nothing. That's a very interesting proposition, especially because most Hollywood executives are under contract. That's the culture of Hollywood.
Yeah, that would come as unwelcome news to people who think they have some security, such as Rob Moore, the vice chairman of Paramount, who we haven't even talked about. He was just fired abruptly in that Troubled Studios latest twist. He has several years left on his contract. And I think when that happens to people, you know, it's nice to be paid if you don't know what your next job is going to be and, you know, feel a little security. Netflix proudly points to a culture where you don't have contracts and you work there. And if you become less than brilliant, they say if your performance is adequate, expect a nice severance payment. So, you know, that's Silicon Valley meets the culture of Hollywood.
Yeah. There are companies in Silicon Valley that do contracts and do have that. And if you are a top executive at Netflix, you get certain grants of stock and other things that would normally accrue in a contractual situation. But it's a very interesting contrast because Netflix is essentially arguing that they can go out and poach whoever they want and they're not going to be responsible for it. And if I was a manager at a Hollywood studio, that would terrify me because, you know, these companies are only as good as the people working there. And if Netflix can just come in with their deep pockets and their $40 billion valuation and pick out the best people, that's going to lead to a brain drain at typical studios.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Television writer-producers Tara Butters and Mark Guggenheim have been married almost 12 years. When they met, Guggenheim, who had bailed on a legal career to write for television, was working on Law & Order. Butters and her writing partner, Michelle Fazekas, were on the staff of one of the show's many spinoffs.
I was working on Law & Order SVU, and our offices were across the hall. And he was one of the lawyer writers for Law & Order. And so Michelle and I would always be in his office asking, okay, how do you do, if we want this to happen, what do we have to do?
Yeah, that was awesome. That's a great way to impress someone. And I didn't have a couch in my office. I hung out in Tara and Michelle's office quite a bit, you know, as friends. But there was a period in my first year on the show where I was doing rewrites on a freelancer script. And I spent two nights at the office, and I would tell the cleaning staff, don't lock Tara's office so I could sleep on her couch. You know, I think that was really the beginning of, you know, Tara's like, oh, I really want to be married to that guy.
Butters and Fizikas went on to executive produce Reaper on the CW and Resurrection on ABC. Meanwhile, Guggenheim formed a partnership with TV mega producer Greg Berlanti, as he recently told Michael Schneider, host of KCRW's podcast, The Spinoff.
I was working on a show called Jack and Bobby.
Oh, yeah. I remember Jack and Bobby.
Yeah.
On the WB.
Yeah. I actually left Law & Order to go work on Jack and Bobby. And that's how I met Greg.
Okay.
We hit it off. And then, you know, what happened was Jack and Bobby got canceled. Another show sort of gone before its time.
Right.
But Greg and I always kept in touch. And we developed Eli Stone together and did Brothers and Sisters together and Ordinary Family together. And long story short, we wrote the Green Lantern movie together along with Michael Green. And right before Green Lantern came out, I got out of my ABC deal and he got out of his ABC deal and he went to Warner Brothers. And when he went to Warner Brothers, he had mentioned to Peter Roth, he had an idea for how to do the Green Arrow character as a TV series. Then Green Lantern came out and was received the way Green Lantern was received.
Mm-hmm.
And neither one of us, I think, were all that eager to do another DC character with Green in his name. But we were able to work out a circumstance where the studio network allowed us to develop Arrow without a lot of attention. Like, there was never anything in the trades about it. And without a lot of interference, we were just able to go in and do it.
What did you learn from Green Lantern, which unfortunately wasn't received well, that both you and Greg learned that you sort of applied to when you started developing Arrow?
You know, honestly, I think we would both tell you the same thing, which is control. You know, at the end of the day, you know, Green Lantern was a feature and we're TV writers and, you know, the script ultimately got taken away from us. It was ultimately given to originally Greg was going to direct. You know, it was ultimately given to a quote-unquote more proven feature film director. And we just sort of lost control of it. So that's why when we did Arrow, it was very much like, we need to do this our way. You know, not to be jerks about it, but to be like, if we're going to go down, we have to go down swinging on our vision. We can't, like, have our vision co-opted by somebody else.
And what's interesting is at the time, you know, Smallville had been off the air for a couple years. So, you know, all the talk of superheroes and comic books was mostly on the feature side. And the CW at that point was still sort of getting over its Gossip Girl stage and was figuring out where it was going next. When you guys launched Arrow, it was sort of the start of a new era of comic book TV. Talk about that and, you know, what your expectations were, what the network and studio's expectations were.
Well, I'll tell you, our goal was we just want this to be good. We weren't thinking like, it's a superhero show. In fact, it really wasn't conceived as a superhero show. It was just conceived of as a dark, gritty crime drama that happened to be based on a comic book. And the studio network's expectations were incredibly high because the CW was sort of at this place where they really, really needed this show to work. And everyone communicated that to us in a wide variety of different ways. And we were very lucky. It did work. And I will say, I think, you know, it worked for a variety of different reasons. I think, you know, we wrote the right script. David Nutter is the Steven Spielberg of television pilots. You know, Stephen Amell was the perfect bit of casting. The CW marketed it brilliantly. You know, the right time slot. It takes so many different things to make a hit.
Arrow returns to the CW for its fifth season on October 5th. Guggenheim is also co-showrunner on the DC show Legends of Tomorrow, which is back for a second season on October 13th. But a couple of years ago, while Guggenheim was thoroughly entrenched in the DC Arrowverse, ABC made Butters the showrunner of its new Marvel TV series, Agent Carter. The show, which ran for two seasons before it was canceled earlier this year, starred Hayley Atwell as Peggy Carter, a secret agent in the 1940s.
I've been wallowing in it since the war, wondering why no one would give Agent Peggy Carter a shot. So I grabbed the chance.
While Guggenheim and Butters were immersed in their respective universes, the philosophical and business differences between DC and Marvel came into sharp focus.
I mean, it definitely is interesting because you're playing in the same kind of arena, but both DC and Marvel are so different in so many ways. And like tonally, I mean, we were much lighter in tone than Arrow.
You know, there are times where, like, I would look at Agent Carter and I'd be very jealous of Tara's budget. It's all in good fun, though, because here's the thing, like, you know, we are fans of each other's work. So it's hard to be in competition with someone who actually, like, writes the kind of stuff you wish you were writing.
Is there sort of a rivalry when it comes to how Marvel treats its shows versus DC, or, hey, look at what Marvel gets to do versus look at what DC gets to do? Do you kind of compare and contrast the two?
Marvel and DC have sort of crafted two different business models. Marvel's decide everything's continuity, everything's in canon, and everything's related. Mm-hmm. That's going to dictate, to a certain extent, what can be done in TV and film in a way that's very, very different from the way DC has approached it, which is we have a cinematic universe and we have not even one television universe. There's, you know, the Berlantiverse, but then there's shows outside of it, like Gotham, for example.
Right.
So they're just very, very different.
The other thing you're dealing with is Marvel's stuff is at Netflix and ABC. That's a different business model.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, weirdly, yeah, Agent Carter's budget may have been bigger than what Arrow was, but part of that was shooting in Los Angeles, the actors having the fact that we had people from the cinematic universe, and, you know, we were doing the 1940s. I mean, we had our own sort of issue. Like, every outfit had to be made. I mean, like, there were certain things that we kind of had to do that was very different than what you were doing in the DC universe.
Oh, but totally. Like, the first two episodes of Legends this year, we're going to the 1940s, and I get visual effect shots in, and I hate to say it, but I'm grading them against the curve of Agent Carter. I'm like, it has to be at least as good as Agent Carter.
Yeah.
And that's a hard bar. Also, you know, DNEG and ILM, you know, they do features. They're you know, they do movies, not television shows.
You're right in that they're two very different sort of business models. You know, there's been a lot of discussion. Okay, so what does that mean? You know, the MCU, obviously, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, they're really just killing it in features right now. You know, the ratings have been a little more troubled. They've struggled a little bit more at mm-hmm. ABC. We, of course, don't know what those Netflix numbers are. We never will. You know, creatively, they're strong shows. But DC, very different in mm-hmm. that there's church and state between film and TV. And you know, the fact is they're even doing an entirely different Flash movie mm-hmm. With different characters. Which, you know, some people might say is a little confusing. Should there be more of a cross-pollinization between film and TV, or is that just a different world?
You know, I'll tell you, I think probably, you know, Tara would say the same thing on the Marvel side. There's pros and cons to both. You know, the comic book fan in me loves the shared universe of the way Marvel approaches it. That said, I think the fact that there can be a Flash in feature film and a Flash in television probably opens up, you know, more opportunities.
It definitely, on the side for us, for Marvel, it was hard because characters that they know down the line they're going to do stuff with features were not available to the TV shows. And so, there is different struggles for each side, because as much as I love that shared universe, there were times where I would look at what you were doing in Arrow and go, oh, you get to have Slade Wilson. You get to have these characters that I recognize on your show because you can kind of mix it up and they don't have to, there could be two of them.
You mentioned ABC and Netflix, and you worked with ABC on Agent Carter. The Netflix shows are very different. Mm-hmm. You have a desire? Would you like to do one of the sort of the grittier, more
Oh, we unique? Would love that.
Yeah.
It definitely hits several things for Michelle and I. We love the action adventure. We love the humor that can be put in. Plus, the fact is you're getting at real emotions through this different type of storytelling. You know, I'm hopeful that we will get to play in that sandbox again.
You can hear more of Michael Schneider's interview with writer-producers and married couple Tara Butters and Mark Guggenheim on KCRW's podcast, The Spinoff. Coming up after a short break, documentary filmmakers Rod Blackhurst and Brian McGinn tell us how they convinced Amanda Knox and the Italian prosecutor who fought for her murder conviction to appear in their movie. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. After British student Meredith Kircher was found brutally murdered in Perugia, Italy in 2007, news stories quickly focused less on the victim than her roommate, Amanda Knox.
The cult of the girl known as Foxy Noxy is why Italians are calling this the trial of the decade.
You're talking about it. Everyone is talking about it.
Sex.
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 A drug-fueled sex game.
Drug-fueled sex game.
A drug-fueled sex game gone wrong.
Knox spent the next 9 years as fodder for tabloids and more mainstream media. She was twice convicted of the murder and spent 4 years in prison before she was released in 2011 and finally acquitted last year by the Italian Supreme Court. Well before that ruling, 5 years ago, Rod Blackhurst and Brian McGinn set out to make a documentary that would attempt to get to the truth. That meant getting Knox, who now lives back home in Seattle, to talk on camera. At first, that was something she was loath to do after years of being hounded by the press.
Crazy. The whole world knew who I had ever had sex with.
She was terrified.
Amanda!
I felt like a child again. And I knew. I was a kid.
The new documentary, simply titled Amanda Knox, is now available on Netflix. When the filmmaker spoke to KCRW's Madeline Brand, Blackhurst said the impetus for the movie was the relentless media coverage of the Knox case.
Well, in 2011, when we started looking into this as a story or as a film that we could dig into, what we saw is that everybody the world over seemingly had an idea about who these people were. And they had an idea that was maybe built by these narratives that they had been presented in the headlines and in the way the media was, you know, talking about the story. And so we wanted to understand, you know, why this had happened, why this event that had happened 4 years prior had turned into this, you know, 4 year long story at that point in time. And what was so captivating about it to people that they were engaging with it the way they did, and past that to understand maybe who these people were that were living at the heart of the story, that were having all of these judgments and ideas applied to them and made about them.
She, Amanda Knox, is in your movie. You interview her, and she has been interviewed before. She's obviously been the subject of intense press scrutiny for many, many years. How did you get her to decide, yeah, I want to do this interview?
Well, we first approached Amanda when she and Raffaele were acquitted in 2011. We flew to Seattle and we met with her several times. And at the time, she decided that she didn't want to participate in a documentary. And we respected that. And we told her that, you know, if she wanted to talk to us, that we would be there when she was ready. And we told that to Giuliano Manini as well.
The prosecutor.
The prosecutor in the case in Italy. What we saw is that, of course, a lot of people wanted to hear from these individuals, but they all were on guard a little bit because people were coming to them with an agenda. Maybe not an agenda based on necessarily how they felt about them, but with an agenda to get something out on the evening news or the nightly news. And I think they all saw that once we started talking to them and our point of view was to make a human story in their words, which they hadn't been afforded the opportunity to do before, again, no matter which side of the, you know, the courtroom you're on, they saw that we were being honest and true to our motivations as filmmakers and the type of film we wanted to make. And Amanda decided on her own in the end of 2013 that she was ready to sit down for an interview. And what we saw then was that Giuliano Minnini in later in 2015 decided it was the right time for him to sit down with us and talk. And that's because maybe these moments were in line with the different legal proceedings that were happening. You know, Amanda spoke to us at a pivotal moment where there was something on the line. You know, she was facing a new conviction. And Giuliano Minnini talked to us after the Italian Supreme Court came to their final conclusion, maybe because he hadn't been heard as well. They all felt like they had something to say, and we wanted to hear it from them in their own words.
Does he still think she's guilty?
It's hard to know. I think at the end of the film, Giuliano Minnini talks about how, you know, if they are innocent, that he hopes that, you know, they can find some comfort in this process and that, you know, they can be okay with it. But that if they are guilty, that, you know, they certainly will face a final judgment at the end of their life. And that, of course, that's reflective of who he is and the things that he believes as an individual.
He's a staunch Catholic.
Giuliano Minnini is a Catholic man, but he's a father of four girls. And I think it's important to realize that these are all real people. And that's something that we all lost track of in talking about these people that became characters in the story about them, almost this like Hitchcockian nightmare. And it's very easy to say, well, Giuliano Minnini is X, Y, and Z, or, you know, and come to some judgment or conclusion. But there he is as a very real man, you know, with a family and with, yeah, a point of view that, of course, we all have our own points of view on things. And so it's important to see him as a real person in that moment and not just somebody that you could agree with or disagree with.
I guess, but then you kind of want to hear from someone who, I mean, she spent 4 years in jail, right? Her 20s were pretty much taken over by this. And that's a period of your life, her life, she can't get back. And no one in the film expresses any remorse for putting her through that.
That's true. I think that's possibly a reflection of the way that the story has remained so divisive, that even though the Supreme Court in Italy has come to a conclusion and the case is totally over, there are still so many people that disagree with that decision. And I think it also speaks to kind of the way that everyone saw Amanda. I think there's an element of, you know, gender norms and cultural norms that ties into this story, in that, you know, from the very beginning, people saw her through this lens of her behavior, right? They wanted to look into her eyes. They wanted to see, you know, why is she behaving the way she's behaving? And then to kind of analyze that as a way of kind of tracking her guilt or innocence and coming to a conclusion about it. And so I would imagine that in some respects that, you know, that kind of analysis doesn't necessarily always lead to, you know, people switching their positions. And I think that really has something to do with that.
That was also, though, the problem, right, that she was so unknowable. She projected opaque. Yeah, she projected this kind of unknowingness about her, and people just filled in their own ideas of her. And right. had she acted differently? Had she had a different personality? Had she portrayed herself in a different manner? Maybe things would have been a lot different.
Yeah, that's the, and I think that's such a universal human thing to look at the person across from you and come to a conclusion about what's going on emotionally and psychologically inside of them based on the way they project themselves. That's how we all communicate, right? And so that became such a linchpin issue in this story, is like, what is she doing? You know, is she showing enough emotion? Is she not showing enough emotion? You know, how is she behaving? And all of these things became the ways in which the kind of public opinion was shaped. And, you know, we really did want to dive into that in the film.
We talk about the role of the media and tabloid journalism in creating this story. And I'm just wondering, you know, Amanda Knox, when you see it up on the billboards driving through town, you're like, ooh, you get that little frisson, that little sensationalist, I don't know, feeling, if you felt that you were contributing to that at all or taking advantage of that at all.
Well, the way the film has been designed is, you know, based largely on the way the story was told to us, right?
And I think the other element is that, you know, when we set out to make the film, I think that the number one important thing for us was to not make a sensationalist film. And I think that when people sit down and watch the movie, they'll see that it's actually not playing into those same kind of hysteria that we've seen around this story for so long.
And so, yet you're drawing people in by saying Amanda Knox and having her picture and...
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, when the kind of framework of the entire story has been about this one person, it's only natural that people want to know more about her. And so I think in a lot of ways that becomes an entry point to a story that hopefully has much larger cultural and societal implications.
That's Rod Blackhurst and Brian McGinn. They are the directors of the new documentary, Amanda Knox. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.